I see no good options, but I'm very fearful of the no option strategy.
Alaska's delegation votes on the president's request to arm rebels to fight ISIS. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a one-man political action group sets his sights on state legislative races.
They know what words resonate at voting time, and they're just saying those words. They're not living up to the words.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Congress today approved President Obama's request to arm and train Syrian rebels to fight the terrorist group known as ISIS, but no one in the Alaska delegation was happy about it. Alaska Congressman Don Young voted for the measure, saying it was a tough choice, but the only way to stop the atrocities and prevent the group from attacking on U.S. soil. Senator Lisa Murkowski also voted for it as part of a short-term spending bill to keep the government operating. She said before the vote she was greatly reluctant and knows Americans are weary of war.
We don't willingly want to do this, but I think Americans are looking at this and saying, by doing nothing, are we putting ourselves as a nation at greater risk from these barbaric acts?
The bill expires December 11th, so Murkowski says Congress will have to face the question again after the election. For now, she says it boils down to selecting among bad options.
And so I look at what we have in front of us, and I see no good options, but I'm very fearful of the no option strategy.
The issue cuts across normal party and ideological lines. The sole Democrat in the Alaska delegation, Senator Mark Begich, voted against the bill. In a speech on the Senate floor before the vote, Begich criticized Obama's plan to arm moderate Syrian rebels to fight extremists, saying it could backfire because alliances often shift.
Do not arm with U.S. dollars and weapons the rebels of today who may not be the rebels of tomorrow.
Begich says the U.S. should continue airstrikes, but he says the Arab countries who are also threatened by ISIS need to provide the ground troops.
What is the long-term plan here for sustainability in the Middle East to get rid of these terrorist organizations that every single one of those countries know is bad for them? They know it, but they don't step up to the plate enough.
Begich was one of only 22 senators to vote no. His Republican challenger, Dan Sullivan, said in a written statement he would have voted for the measure because ISIS is a threat to the U.S. It's not unheard of for wealthy individuals to get involved in ballot measure fights. This year alone, grocery magnate Barney Gottstein put $100,000 toward a failed oil tax referendum, and financier Bob Gillum has spent more than $1 million supporting an initiative to slow the development of the Pebble Mine. But what is unusual is for a single person to sweep into legislative races and operate basically like a super PAC. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports attorney Brad Keithley is doing just that, targeting a handful of Anchorage races.
There are really only a couple things Brad Keithley spends his money on. Traveling to music festivals.
I went to Scotland to the Orkney Folk Festival. I went to Ireland to the Doolin Folk Festival. I've been to Cape Breton.
And politics.
I'm doing an independent expenditure campaign that is going to participate through mailers and through advertising in certain legislative races.
Keithley plans to spend $200,000, give or take, in a quest to install his vision of a more fiscally responsible legislature in Juneau. After collecting candidate surveys and studying the races, he's supporting two Democratic challengers, Lori Hummel against the incumbent Republican Gabrielle Ledoux in Muldoon, and Matt Moore against House Majority Leader Lance Pruitt in East Anchorage. In West Anchorage, he's backing a Republican, Anandu Bay, against Democrat Matt Clayman, congressman in a race for an open seat. And in Mountain View, he's spending on behalf of Libertarian C.Ann Stevens, who is trying to unseat Democratic Representative Garen Tarr.
And these are districts where we think we can move the needle.
So why is he doing all this? For the past 2 years, Keith Lee has been a regular at the state capitol, preaching a gospel of budget caps. But while he thought his message of limiting state spending to $5 billion was resonating, the last two state budgets each went over that mark by a billion or two.
We went backwards rather than saving. We had the two highest deficits in Alaska's history.
To make up the difference, the legislature and governor had to tap the state's budget reserves, basically a $15 billion piggy bank the state can dip into when there's shortfalls. Keatley thinks that instead of draining the reserves, Alaska should let the funds grow and then use the interest to counteract declining revenue from oil production. He says he thought there was buy-in for that plan from the Republican majorities 2 years ago. Now, Keith Lee sees it differently.
They know what words constituents want to hear. They know what words resonate at voting time. And they're just saying those words. They're not living up to the words.
Keith Lee has a few objectives with his independent expenditure campaign. Obviously, he'd like his chosen candidates to be successful, but he also wants to get people talking about the state budget. And he believes his spending could have an effect in other races. Keith Lee has been a vocal critic of Governor Sean Parnell's limited use of the line item veto during the past legislative cycle. And he thinks his advertising may have a ripple effect on that race.
The mailers certainly are going to identify, and the web advertising is going to say, this is both the governor and the legislature that have been doing this. It's both Alaska's chief executive and its board of directors that have sent the state down this, that's sending the state down this path. So it may have some carryover effect in the governor's race, and that's certainly not going to bother me.
Needless to say, the independent expenditure effort has ruffled feathers. Keith Lee, who isn't registered with a party but describes his views as libertarian, says he's lost friends over it. Republicans have accused him of simply trying to elect Democrats. He says people also wonder why he's putting $200,000 into political spending instead of toward philanthropy. Keith Lee, who wouldn't disclose his net worth, but says he's financially secure after a career as an oil and gas attorney, says he does give money to other causes. And in a weird way, he sees political contributions as having more of an impact than giving to a specific charity.
It creates a better world for that philanthropy and for that small segment, but it doesn't improve the economy of the state, or it doesn't hand off a better world, a better state fiscal world to the next generation.
Keith Lee says he's also prepared to be negatively compared to political spenders like the Koch brothers and George Soros, who are viewed as election-influencing boogeymen by the left and right, respectively. Though he sees himself more like billionaire Ross Perot, who self-financed a 1992 presidential run centered on reducing the national debt.
You know, Ross Perot may have lost that election, but he changed the discussion. He changed the dynamic.
Keith Lee even considered pulling a Ross Perot and running for governor. But after some self-reflection, he realized he just wasn't a good candidate and didn't have a shot at victory. So he figured he may as well put money behind people who did have a chance. After all, he thought that was a fiscally responsible approach. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking at what has changed in Arctic development in the last decade.
It's not meant to be a scholarly journal article. It is actually meant to be something that teachers can have their students read.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Crowley, fueling Alaska for more than 60 years with a full range of residential, commercial, aviation, and marine fuel products. Crowley also fuels community events, from summer fun runs to public radio. More at crowleyfuels.com.
Until recently, Governor Sean Parnell, like his two Republican predecessors and Governor Wally Hickel before them, used lawsuits, legislative initiatives, and policies to dispute or diminish tribal authorities on several fronts. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, the Parnell administration now is taking a step toward acknowledging tribal sovereignty.
Over the past few decades, the state of Alaska has launched several lawsuits challenging tribal sovereignty, subsistence, and tribal jurisdiction over Indian child welfare, cases in which the U.S. Supreme Court and Alaska Supreme Court came down on the side of tribes. And the Parnell administration successfully lobbied to have Alaska tribes excluded from provisions in the Violence Against Women Act that allow tribes to prosecute domestic violence crimes committed by non-Indian perpetrators, a move the Indian Law and Order Commission called unconscionable given Alaska's high rates of violence against women. So a new agreement it's negotiating with tribes is quite a turnabout for the state.
First of all, the agreement does reflect sovereign recognition, which I know is important to many tribes.
That's Alaska Department of Law attorney Jackie Schaefer speaking at a substance abuse conference last week in Anchorage. She gave a presentation on a proposed agreement that would divert civil misdemeanor cases to tribal courts. The agreement acknowledges tribes exist and doesn't deny tribal sovereignty, but stops short of affirming it.
The agreement doesn't change the tribe's own laws or its sovereignty. It simply lays out the terms of the state and the tribe's cooperation.
The diversion agreement would allow tribes to handle certain alcohol-related, juvenile, domestic violence, and other misdemeanor charges, and Schaefer says tribes would be authorized to prosecute non-Native offenders if the offender agrees.
The arresting officer, which can be a trooper, it can be a DPSO, and depending on the community, if they have a tribal police officer, they would offer people who commit certain offenses that fall under this agreement the option to receive a tribal civil remedy in tribal court instead of being prosecuted in state court. And both tribal members and non-members can choose to have their case heard in the tribal court.
Brenda Wilson of King Cove says the change is long overdue.
And the way that I'm interpreting it is what used to be done a long time ago, where the elders and the people come together. This person is talked to, they do what they need to do. What we call it is restitution. And what you're talking about, wood chopping or helping elders doing things, this comes in agreement with that person. And that person then, once they've completed all their agreed issues, whether it's go to treatment or do the activities, and they have to be accountable.
Courts have repeatedly affirmed tribal sovereignty and, in a recent case, affirmed tribal jurisdiction over non-members in civil cases involving tribal members. Ingrid Cumberledge of Sandpoint told conference participants the agreement doesn't offer anything new.
Right now, as tribal courts, you can hear these cases now. Your appeal to a state, you have the ability to hear these cases.
Lisa Yeager, a tribal government specialist for the regional nonprofit corporation Tanana Chiefs Conference, says the agreement does give state troopers and village public safety officers clear authority to divert misdemeanor cases to tribal courts.
It kind of hands up, you know, an avenue to tribes to be able to use state resources and sentence people without their people getting, you know, the state record and being able to do it in a restorative justice manner. Tribes already do some of these things, but it's not easy for a state trooper to just cite cases right to tribal courts right now.
Yeager says Tanana Chiefs Conference worked with the state to make the terms of the agreement acceptable to tribes in their region in interior Alaska. She says some tribes may not want to handle all the categories of misdemeanors listed or may want other changes. So she says the next step is for interested individual tribes to work with the state to tailor the agreement to their needs. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The State Board of Education will consider regulations surrounding how students can test out of courses they have mastered. Lawmakers this year passed legislation allowing secondary school students to test out of and receive credit for courses offered in math, language arts, science, social studies, and world languages. The proposed regulations would require districts to provide testing at least twice a year and develop standards regarding the degree of mastery needed. In public comments, Ron Feuer, president of NEA Alaska, said the regulations, if implemented properly, would allow students to take more advanced classes. But he said if the testing requirements are too lax, it won't prepare students for long-term success. He also said he didn't want new testing days added to the school calendar. The board meets this week in Anchorage. Researchers and academics from multiple nations are gathering at the University of Alaska Anchorage this week to aggregate research on Arctic development. There are two efforts underway. The first is the initial meeting of Arctic Frost, or Arctic Frontiers of Sustainability, looking at resources and development in a changing north. The idea is to bring together existing international research, clarify the new knowledge, and get the information out to the public and schools. Dr. Diane Hirschberg is the Professor of Education Policy and Director of UAA's Center for Alaska Education Policy Research. She says in addition to Arctic Frost, the second Arctic Human Development Report will be released. The baseline study was conducted 10 years ago.
There's been a lot of attention to the Arctic, this recognition that we're going to have a lot more access because of opening up of shipping lanes. There's an interesting piece that's happening with the Arctic that China, Japan, Korea, a lot of the Asian countries are beginning to look at what their role is going to be here. So we need to understand and be able to anticipate some of the impacts that this is going to have. So Arctic Human, the other purpose with the Arctic Human Development Report is to make this information accessible. It's not meant to be a scholarly journal article. It is actually meant to be something that teachers can have their students read, that policymakers can grab as a resource to get a broad overview when they are then trying to understand perhaps what their responses need to be on particular Arctic issues within their own nation or their own state.
I know that you're going to be, of course, talking more comprehensively about these issues in the next few days as Arctic Frost unfolds, but can you give us a little bit of a glimpse into what some of the differences have been in this decade from the baseline study of the Arctic Human Development Report 1 till this current decade later, Arctic Development 2?
Well, I think, you know, the area I know best, of course, is education. That's the chapter I worked on. And what we are looking at is perhaps what hasn't changed, which is in some cases a bit distressing. And that is both struggles to get students in rural and remote communities and those who are indigenous to complete high school and move into other opportunities, a continuing and widening gender gap between men and women, and perhaps not the direction that many people realize, but that women in our rural and remote communities tend to be getting advancing faster in education. They are moving out of the communities. That's another piece that is discussed in the report is the continuing out-migration from rural communities. Some of the people that are going to be talking on Friday will be really talking about some of the economic shifts that are happening as well. And boy, I'll tell you, that's with resource extraction, that is such a fast-moving area when we talk about whether it's new discoveries on oil and coal or some of the shifts in renewable resources. And also what's happening with fishing and populations of caribou and such. There are people who are addressing those issues in the chapters.
With the current situation with Russia, there's some Arctic Frost there in the relationship. Does this impact how research is done collaboratively? What happens in this setting, are you finding that this is a problem or not?
right now, we're not finding a immediate problem in terms of the impact of the uncertainty with Russia and the U.S. and Europe. However, we're really worried about this. There are repeated statements being made in different international Arctic research settings, whether at the International Congress of Arctic Social Sciences or yesterday at the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, that the research collaborations need to continue regardless of the political strife that's going on. And we really need to keep those relationships strong and continuous.
Dr. Diane Hirschberg is a professor of education policy. There will be a free public event to discuss the Sustainable Arctic Development findings on Friday evening at 7 p.m. at UAA's Consortium Library. A Coast Guard spokesman says a 30-foot commercial fishing boat exploded and burned Wednesday evening in the small boat harbor in Valdez. The lone person on board was able to walk off and was taken to a hospital. Lieutenant Ben Bauman says Valdez firefighters and police responded, as did Coast Guard personnel. They found the vessel Fireman afloat with the majority of its wheelhouse torn apart by the explosion. Once Valdez firefighters said the area was safe, Bauman said Coast Guard officers were able to board the boat to begin a pollution investigation. The cause of the explosion is under investigation.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The REAA School Board election is October 7th. Polls are open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Today, the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities put out a draft document that addresses environmental issues stemming from the battle to extend Juneau's only highway north toward Haines and Skagway. The 694-page draft supplemental environmental impact statement for the Juneau Access Project is a reaction to court challenges to the 2006 environmental impact statement. The new document maintains a preference to build a road along the east side of Lynn Canal, north to the Katsaheen River. There, a new ferry terminal would make a short connection to Haines and the road system. The new document attempts to fulfill a major regulatory hurdle to highway construction, estimated at $523 million. Ferry terminal and vessel construction is estimated to cost another $51 million. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council was one of the parties to challenge the 2006 environmental impact statement. It may do so again, says Executive Director Melina Marvin.
Our lawyers have not analyzed it yet, but it's likely that it will be challenged.
The federal courts in 2009 and 11 said the original statement failed to adequately consider improved ferry service as an alternative to building the road. The new document addresses that and revises outdated information. DOT spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the next step for the department is to collect public comments that will eventually be integrated into an additional report.
Depending on how many comments we receive, will determine the length of time it takes us to actually put together the environmental impact statement for a review by the Federal Highway Administration before we can reach a record of decision. So that could take several months or longer.
The public comment period on the draft document is open until November 10th. A number of regional fishing associations are joining forces to strengthen the Magnuson-Stevens Act. The Sitka-based Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association announced last week that it's reached an agreement with the Alaska Marine Conservation Council and several East Coast industry groups to form the Fishing Community Coalition. The new organization wants to ensure that Congress makes protecting fish stocks a priority. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Draft language containing proposed changes to Magnuson-Stevens has been working its way through the U.S. House of Representatives, but the political lines became clearer when Florida's Republican Senator Marco Rubio introduced his version of the bill on September 16th. The top priority for Rubio is giving the regional management councils more flexibility in setting timelines for rebuilding depleted fish stocks. This is exactly what Linda Benkin, the director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, was hoping not to hear.
there's quite a pushback right now against the rebuilding timelines and catch limits. You start rebuilding stocks means you have to catch less fish generally, and that's a painful process.
Benkin says she wasn't expecting a Senate bill so soon, but Rubio's parallels some language she's seen in the House. The Fishing Community Coalition is worried about a reauthorization that merely reaffirms the status quo, or worse, moves backward. The Magnuson-Stevens Act was first passed in 1976 and wasn't considered very effective for its first two decades, but substantial amendments in 1996 and 2006 reinforced the law's commitment to sustainability. Benkin would like to stay the course.
To protect the gains that we've made in the last two reauthorizations for the resource, and then also to look for ways to support policy that keeps a healthy resource and also provides access for people who live in traditional fishing communities to those resources.
Benkin served three terms on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, one of eight regional councils established under Magnuson-Stevens.
We definitely have some out here with our Georges Bank and Gulf of Maine cod stocks that are a mess.
Tom Dempsey is the policy director of the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance.
And they're collapsing right in front of us. And we need to improve how we manage those stocks.
As recently as 30 years ago, there were 60 boats fishing for cod throughout the summer out of Chatham, Massachusetts, where Dempsey lives. Today, there are two part-time boats. Dempsey also holds a seat on the New England Fisheries Management Council. He says there's a tendency to distrust science in his area, and unlike Alaska, no annual stock assessment.
But when you're managing fish, you really only have to answer two questions, and that's how many fish are in the water and how many fish are you taking out.
Senator Rubio's bill includes provisions to increase funding for stock assessments and data collection, but the track record of success of Magnuson-Stevens outside of Alaska is not stellar. And although giving the council's flexibility to depart from strict conservation guidelines may become the most politically charged idea in the reauthorization process, Alpha's Linda Benkin says it doesn't have to be. She says flexibility, as in the use of new data collection tools like cameras rather than onboard observers, can actually be a good thing.
That kind of flexibility doesn't compromise the resource, but it is really important to small boats and to fishing communities.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Jennifer Canfield and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson project, proving energy lives here. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.